From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Especially today, there's not that much room for you to play with pastels. You know, you got to paint with bolder colors. You really have to pick a lane. And if you have too many lanes available, then everyone in their head is picking a different lane.
Veteran TV writer-producer Rob Long was brought in on short notice to fix the faltering CBS sitcom Kevin Can Wait. Long, who made his name on the classic sitcom Cheers, says network TV requires a clear vision from the start. Long talks about getting the series back on track, why he hopes there's not a writer's strike, and what it's like to be one of the few outspoken conservatives in Hollywood. But first on the news banter, buckle up. Universal goes all in with the fate of the Furious at CinemaCon. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany, The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, as you know, Matt, this past week in Las Vegas, the Theater Owners of America gathered for CinemaCon. And this is an annual event where theater owners gather and the studios take turns presenting their upcoming movies. And what they're trying to do is get these guys super excited about booking their movies into their theaters and that they're going to sell a lot of popcorn. You know, some of them come in more advantaged than others, like i.e. Disney, or, you know, they just have been on such a tear that I'm sure that whatever they say this is going to be good, theater owners are willing to give them at least the benefit of the doubt. And in some cases, you know, you see the studios throwing down. Disney showed all of Pirates of the Caribbean and Universal showed all of Fate of the Furious, which is the next in the Fast and the Furious franchise. And it's the first one without, you know, really without Paul Walker, who was sort of reconstructed through computer magic in the last one. So they want to keep it going. And, you know, it doesn't always work out to show the full movie. I don't know that either one of these was considered an absolute home run by people who saw the whole thing, but some people were very enthusiastic.
They were. And, you know, this is one of those things where they show the people who care about the popcorn movies the most. There were no critics invited to these screenings, and there was a very strict embargo on reactions. You couldn't say too much about what you saw. But the stuff that we saw and the reporters that we had there said they were fine, you know, summer blockbuster type movies. But the takeaway from CinemaCon to me is this ongoing tension between the studios and the theater owners. The business is moving away from the traditional model of put a movie in theaters for a couple months, wait 90 days or 120 days, and then put it on home video. The studios really want to collapse that window and make it a either day and date experience or a 30-day experience where you can get a movie at home for a premium price much sooner than currently is available. And the theater owners are pushing back on that. And I think right now the studios are getting an upper hand and are kind of, you know, ready to make their move on what this offering is going to be.
You know, you have three studios, Universal, Warner's, and Fox, leading the charge on this. And we're looking at the idea that you would pay $30 to $50 and you would then be able to watch something a bit sooner than you would under the current system. And, you know, if you factor in the cost of parking, babysitter, popcorn, et cetera, it doesn't necessarily make it a terrible deal from a consumer point of view. I mean, I think people reflexively say, I don't want to pay that much. But when they think it through, they may. And the issue here, of course, is that the theaters, in exchange for allowing this, will want to be cut in on a piece of the profits. And that will be a big negotiation. I think that that's going to be where it really gets down to brass tacks and we see who fights with whom and who gives in. And we also have an issue of, you know, how filmmakers feel. This is an emotional thing for certain filmmakers. And certain filmmakers, as we know, are very big gorillas in this business. And that was underscored by what happened when Chris Nolan, who has this upcoming movie Dunkirk and is certainly among the most powerful producers in Hollywood, appeared right after Sue Kroll of Warner's, who was touting the idea of shortening the window.
Yeah, that was embarrassing for her because she was saying what, you know, the studio position has been on this issue, which is to, you know, get these movies to consumers in the way that they increasingly want to see them. And then her most powerful filmmaker gets on stage right after her and says, you know, that's really not for me. But I think a sea change is coming here. We are going to see this year, for the first time, Netflix really getting into the movie business and the blockbuster movie business. You're going to see a Netflix movie from Brad Pitt later this year, War Machine. You're going to see a Netflix movie from Will Smith, Bright. And those are two traditional blockbuster stars. And these movies are going to be marketed just like a blockbuster studio movie that's only in theaters, but it's going to be in the home on Netflix right when it comes out. And I think that is going to help pave the way for the studios to make the argument that if they want to compete in this new economy, yes, there will always be a market for the theatrical experience. People like to go to the movies. They like to get out of the house. But you've got to give people more choice if they're willing to pay for it.
Nonetheless, of course, the studios want these movies to play in theaters. That's how you get a profile. I mean, the challenge has always been if it just appears on a streaming service, it's not as much of a profile as a thing that's released in a few thousand theaters. I thought it was funny. Tom Rothman from Sony Pictures tried to make that point. You know, he showed some footage from Blade Runner, which was apparently super splashy. He had some choice words about Netflix.
Yeah, choice words were Netflix my ass, which got a big laugh in the room. But I can't imagine that Tom Rothman's colleagues at Sony Pictures Television, who make a lot of money selling their product to Netflix, were laughing as hard as he was. But it really just shows the tension there. I mean, Tom Rothman, the head of Sony, is feeling the heat from Netflix. And there is this movement towards more entertainment in the home. And what he is essentially saying is you can't get this same feeling and the same experience of a movie like the Blade Runner sequel in the home. And a lot of people agree with him, but I don't think that that is a mutually exclusive argument. You can say, yes, there is a market for the theatrical experience, but for people that want to pay for it, there should be an alternative where you can get that movie in the home for a price.
I suspect as a parent of a very small child, Matt, you really understand the power of that argument.
I absolutely do. And I would love to be able to, you know, go see the latest movie in theaters. But, you know, it doesn't happen as often as it used to. And would I pay to see Beauty and the Beast, you know, a week or two after it came out? Probably.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Regular KCRW listeners may have noticed the weekly Hollywood commentary Martini Shot has been on hiatus. Not to fear, it'll be back soon. Martini Shot comes to you from Rob Long, a veteran TV writer and producer who built his career on the long-running sitcom Cheers. Long had to take a break from Martini Shot after he got a call a few months ago asking him to help save a big-ticket CBS sitcom, Kevin Can Wait, starring Kevin James. The series was James's return to television following The King of Queens, which ran for 9 seasons from 1998 through 2007, also on CBS. In Kevin Can Wait, James plays Kevin Gable, a newly retired Long Island cop who wants to hang with his buddies after leaving behind the stress of his job. Naturally, life on the home front with his wife, 3 kids, and a soon-to-be son-in-law is far more hectic than he imagined. Kevin Can Wait is a very down-the-middle old-school sitcom. Here's the opening scene of a recent episode when Kevin's wife, Donna, played by Erin Hayes, finds her husband making a less-than-appealing sandwich.
Hey, babe.
Hey.
Ooh, what are you making?
It started as a BLT, but we ran out of L&T, so I'm just making a BM. It's a bacon and mayonnaise.
Oh.
Kevin Can Wait premiered to strong ratings in September. More than 11 million people watched the pilot episode. But then those numbers started to dip, and there were reports of trouble behind the scenes between Kevin James and the original showrunner. That's where Rob Long, our guest today, came in. We reached him in his current office in Bethpage, New York, a hamlet on Long Island with a population of fewer than 20,000 people, a long way away from Hollywood. Why don't you just tell us the story of how you get a call? And I understand this was all super quick, like drop everything and
yeah. Well, this happens a lot when you, TV now, network television especially, because the stakes are so high. There's always an urge to get things going, to get started, to just get moving. And then sometimes you don't dot all the I's, cross all the T's, or sometimes the team isn't quite working as well together as it should. And I think this was a case where that was the feeling sort of mutually from everybody running the show at the time. So, but the problem is they need somebody, you know, you need a warm body whose job it is to sort of take the flak and take the bullets or just organize things or just keep things on track. And that was sort of me. I was hanging out in New York City. I tried to spend at least half the year there. And I was walking to lunch and I got a call and then they got 10 calls. And then people were saying, hey, are you interested, available? Would you like to go and meet? And I said, sure, I'll go and meet. I'd be happy to meet. So, you know, I take a train out to Bethpage and sit down and talk. And look, it's a TV show. Running a TV show is not complicated, just that there are certain things you have to do. And if you don't do those things, then this calendar is what is your biggest enemy. The calendar is what eats you up.
The calendar?
Right, because you got premiere dates and air dates, and those are all set, and you have to make them. And if one thing goes wrong, if for instance, the stage isn't done right, or if it's happened to us a couple of times here, we've had snow days where it's just too much snow. We can't get a crew in. You have to have some flexibility, and you have to have a cushion built in. And if you're running behind anyway, it can be big trouble.
Of course, this show is on the air, and correct me if I'm wrong, is my understanding that CBS had made a staggering, I think, $50 million commitment to bringing this show, you know, with this Kevin James vehicle onto the air.
Sorry, I just coughed because of that number seems so large. Yeah, no, look, I mean, you get a star of the stature and the popularity of Kevin James, you know, a lot of other things go with it. You got to give him some guarantees. You got to make sure that the show's got a great time slot, and then you know, he wants to be close to his family and he wants to work close to his house. And so all those things end up with, you know, kind of retrofitting an old Grumman plant. I think they built one of the lunar modules here to be a soundstage. And look, it's been a working soundstage for a bunch of years, but we sort of took over one whole section of it and made it a production office and a soundstage and a writer's office. And, you know, you start adding up the inputs, just the financial inputs, they get pretty large. So show's got to work.
So how many stars, network stars, could have the clout to say, build me a studio on Long Island?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you're talking about somebody who's already been successful on television and already been successful in feature films. That's not a big number of people. Probably count them on one hand. And there's a point to it. He wanted to make a show that felt like where he grew up. It's hard to do that in Studio City, but it's not that hard to do that in Bethpage. Other things are hard to do in Bethpage, like... you know, work around the snow. Right. But that's part of fun.
So you are your position here is that the real creative problem was that they had gotten behind and therefore they were unable to kind of really think, I guess, or be as free to create as they should have
been. Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. I just think that they're probably, you know, with a lot of shows like this, especially shows that have this high profile, there's sometimes just a disconnect between what everybody wants from the series. And usually in the development process and in the pilot process, you got about a year to put on, you know, to make 21 minutes of television. The irony is that you spend all this time lovingly adjusting and fixing a pilot, and kind of everybody gets satisfied or everyone gets what they want. But then when you start, you're really like, that's all you got. The way I describe it is that the pilot process is, and the development process is packing. You're packing for this long trip. But when you start and you're on the trip, you suddenly realize, oh man, I brought too many sweaters, or I didn't bring enough sweaters. Whatever it is, we've all had that experience. And you're lugging it around for the rest of your trip. In this case, the trip is, you know, 5 or 6 years. Things you're carrying around are costing you a lot of money. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, I understand, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but it was my understanding that by the time you got there, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 episodes had aired. Is that then the numbers were not?
I think that's right, yeah. 3, maybe more than that, but yeah.
I understand that Kevin James was at the point of saying, I want to walk away from this. I'm not happy.
Well, that'd be news to me. He's not that kind of guy to give up on stuff. I just think that the problem was that there are a bunch of people doing a different show. And you can feel that way when you're in pilot production and development, but you can't when you start to make the episodes. Everyone's got to be rowing in the same direction. The numbers were good. I think the numbers, we're on CBS's number one new comedy. I think we're top four, top five comedy on the air right now.
Yes.
Yeah, so the numbers are good, and they were fine. But I think there's just no room for error. You know, in the old days, it would have been fine. Everyone said, that's great, you know.
How would it have been fine?
Well, you'd had more comedies on the air. We would have probably not been so crucially scheduled to be the Monday 8 p.m. kickoff of the night. Networks had a little more flexibility back then, and now they really don't. They have to have a show that performs, especially CBS, especially now on Monday. So there was some concern just about whether we were going to make our dates or not, and we did. And you know, the reality is that, like everything else, and I'm not trying to downplay my sheer genius and brilliance of doing this, but by the time everyone's aligned and they make the call and they try to make a change, a lot of the problems have sort of resolved themselves. You know, it's sort of like that's the way it is in Hollywood. When they call the fire department, the fire is pretty much taking care of itself. You know, people are always loath to try to change the tires on a bus while the bus is moving. But sometimes that's what you got to do. It's not a business known for its decisiveness. And when you're faced with some of these things and some of these issues, you just got to be decisive. But making a bold choice is almost better than waiting to, and making a slightly better bold choice. Because the trick is to just to make a choice and to get moving.
So you get there, you have no say in casting, no say in storyline. I mean, a lot of the die is, everything is sort of set up to
a certain point.
What impact can you have?
Well, the impact you can have is just on looking at the cards that you have. You know, you have all the elements for a hit TV show. This is just what I said to them when I met. You have everything you need for a hit TV show, just everybody isn't working together and everybody isn't working in the same direction. And so the first thing you do is try to get everybody working in the same direction. And the second thing you do is you try to figure out where we've had success, where we've done really well, and just keep doing that. And the thing that doesn't work, you just don't do that stuff anymore. That's kind of the secret. And you just plod along, and you just, every episode you try to get better, and you try to make sure that your characters are interacting with each other rather than with a guest star. Really simple stuff, but you know, in the craziness and the chaos and the furor of launching a show, any show, that's the stuff that sometimes people forget about. And the series that have been hit TV shows for years and years are almost always the ones that manage to sort of navigate around those rocks. The impulse is always when you have these characters to say, okay, let's bring somebody else in to be the catalyst so these characters can interact. Because I don't really want to make a choice. I don't want my characters to do anything and make a choice, you know, because you're nervous about it. Everybody who does TV is terrified of saying, okay, now I've made a big choice about this character and I can't go back. So instead of doing that, I'll just bring in a guest star and the guest star will do stuff and I will never see the guest star again. That's fine. Natural human impulse. Everybody does it once or twice or even three times at the beginning of the series, but you don't want to do it more than that.
When you say everybody wasn't pulling in the same direction, how did that arise? Do you have any insight into that? Having come in later in the game, you must.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have a guy who has an incredibly successful television legacy in Kevin James. And then he's also got a whole run of feature films. Those characters aren't really the same. You know, they're all him, but it's not really the same. So you have to find it. And I think that this is a show that had a little bit of everything. Had a little bit of a family, had a little bit of a friend, had a little bit of a show about a guy trying to find himself in his second part of his life. It had, you know, had all sorts of elements, but the show, especially in its first season, especially today, there's not that much room for you to play with pastels. You know, you got to paint with bolder colors. You really have to pick a lane. And if you have too many lanes available, then everyone in their head is picking a different lane.
What are the lanes? Can we describe them at all?
Well, sure. I mean, like you have, it's an 8 o'clock family show, right?
Right.
And it's also an 8 o'clock relationship show, husband and wife. It's also an 8 o'clock show about a young, almost married couple. And it's an 8 o'clock show about a guy and his friends and hanging out at the bar with his friends.
Right.
So tones here could be, you get dizzy trying to follow it all. And you just have to sort of start picking and choosing. And I think the audiences want to be surprised, but they don't want to be watching a new show and adjusting their expectations every week. They want you to keep delivering on the same thing. But they also want it to be a little different and a little fresh, and that's what we're trying to deliver.
It's really different. I mean, obviously you made your career early on in Cheers. And this comedy is a very meat and potatoes, CBS, straight-ahead comedy. And Cheers was this very different kind of thing. I mean, is this a reflection of how the networks have changed, how the business has changed? Is it like, you know, is there room for a Cheers type of comedy that is not as meat and potatoes, for want of a better word?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, there definitely is. I mean, I think there's room for everything. I guess that the sad thing that's happening to network television is that the networks are thinking themselves as like branding it. You know, this is a brand. This is our brand is this. Our brand is that. And I always find that silly and kind of roll my eyes as if the audience ever thinks that way. They never think that way. But all the networks, you know, they hire these people to come and give them their brand identity and spend, you know, 3 weeks in some offsite to something or other. The truth is that I think every network would be well served to have some big kind of splashy comedies like ours and have some smart grown-up workplace or one-set comedies like Cheers. And then have a couple of like straight ahead family shows that when you do them well, they can be fantastic. And then maybe, you know, young people ensemble shows. But I'm not quite sure I know why a network has to be branded. It always seems like they're trying to outsmart the audience, which is never, ever, ever a way to be successful.
Coming up after a short break, Rob Long tells us why he hopes the Writers Guild can avoid another strike and why he thinks being a conservative has helped him get jobs in Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to TV writer and showrunner Rob Long. He's currently overseeing the CBS sitcom Kevin Can Wait. When he's not working on the show, Long brings you the KCRW commentary on life in Hollywood, Martini Shot, which Long says will be back on the air soon. For Long and others in the industry, there is a topic top of mind right now, the possibility of another writer's strike. The last strike, almost a decade ago, lasted 100 days and brought a lot of bitterness and recrimination. Then many of the issues in the strike had to do with ad revenue and residuals from streaming media, which was then relatively new. That question of residuals is, again, one of the issues raised by the Writers Guild of America, along with the demand for better health plans and addressing the decline in writers' wages due to shorter TV seasons. The WGA's current contract expires May 1st. So I have to ask you just, I don't know if you can address it, but obviously the Writers Guild has authorized a strike. Is that something you can talk about at all, like what your perception of that is?
Well, I can talk about just the buzz around it, which is that at first, you know, all my showrunner friends were sending around texts and emails when they had the first meeting a couple months ago. I was terrified and I called the studio and I said, look, this happens. What I want you guys to get us is before we leave here, just get us some script orders. Even if the network doesn't want to give us a second season order, give us a script order so we can get started in March and April. And if we're behind, it won't kill us in pre-production. And then everybody kind of rolled their eyes. It's not going to happen. I was not a supporter of the last strike. This one, I still am confused, even though I've read everything. I still am confused as to what the Writers Guild vision for the future is, how they envision what being a writer in the future is. And I'm sympathetic to any argument or any pattern of demands that recognizes that you cannot strike to repeal the future. And no contract has ever been written to, you know, outlaw technology. And I am perfectly willing to support them and support the guild if I feel like their pattern of demands makes sense for what a writer's career in Hollywood's going to be, not today and not in the 50s, but for the next 20 years. Which, frankly, is going to be something that has very little to do with residual payments.
Well, residual payments in a world of Netflix make no sense, really.
I would be gratified and enthusiastic about a union of writers that recognized that fact and focused instead on a whole bunch of other things. Work rules that would make a writer's life, a writer's career more sustainable.
What about streaming participations?
Again, it's like the problem is that we end up focusing on the issues that would affect a successful writer with a product in the marketplace. And that number is very small. And what it allows is a lot of writers who aren't successful and don't have products in the marketplace to fantasize about, oh, I'm going to get ripped off if I do write a script for a hit TV show and that show ends up in syndication and I deserve that money. But even if the writers get everything they want on those sort of ancillary markets, you still can't pay your mortgage. You still can't plan. That's still found money, no matter how you look at it. What the Writers Guild should be focused on, I think, are work rules. How long can you keep a writer on an option without paying him? How long can you keep a project in your vault that a writer worked on without giving it back to the writer to sell to somebody else? I mean, right now we have all these buyers circling around and the writers are not empowered really to use the multiple buyers as leverage. All that stuff is really interesting and important and would be great to talk about, and I'd be thrilled to talk about it. I'm not as educated right now. I've been in production, so I haven't really read all that stuff, but that's what I'm interested in hearing about. A lot less about like, well, I want 2 cents for every time somebody downloads a thing, because the truth is that the business isn't in the business of selling episodes anymore. It's in the business of selling subscriptions. And subscriptions are about a whole constellation of offerings. And, you know, the idea that you're going to get paid for one episode, the 0.00001 cent, and that's going to be something you're going to be able to plan on. Look, I've gotten zillions of dollars in residuals over my career. Lots of money I didn't expect, but I never expected it. You open up your mailbox and, oh, there's this check there. It's fantastic. But if you're planning on that, if you have a family, that's not
a mistake. Yeah.
You're making a big mistake. And there's no guild and no strike and no contract that's going to ever rewrite that reality.
Well, so just to touch on the politics for a sec, you are an out-of-the-closet Hollywood conservative. You probably read that Tim Allen had compared this to being in like Nazi Germany. What's your experience? Do you find that people are negatively dealing with you because you're a conservative?
Maybe. That is possible. I have never experienced it. Never. Quite the reverse. I could probably sit here and with enough time, enough memory, and look through my diary and figure out how much money in Hollywood I've made, not because I was a conservative, but where my politics were somehow helpful to the work I was doing. I actually find people in Hollywood in general to be remarkably open and interested in Hollywood's very, they like to talk about politics and like to argue about politics and they like to mix it up. But I've never felt that anybody said, not him. Can't have him around because he's, represents some political viewpoint I disapprove of. It's never been played back to me, and I don't feel like I've had any setbacks in my career. Certainly none that I didn't cause myself. So I can only say that my experience has been fine. I think that when politics are mentioned on screen in a story or a script, they're kind of uniformly left wing, but big deal. So what?
You had a religious moment in Kevin Can Wait where they talk about God. Is that one that you were in charge of, or?
We do. Look, Kevin is representing the way he lives, the way he was raised, and his area, which is like really Catholic part of the country. And, he wanted to represent it for real, the way a lot of people are. And he's doing a good job of it. I mean, it's fun. I mean, it's not, it's not pious. We're not doing a pious TV show, but we are doing a TV show where family goes to mass, where they know the priest, they play church basketball, and they do stuff like that. It's not a televangelist way, it's just hey, this is the way this family really is, the way a lot of families are.
Had you been to Long Island before, much before this? Were you a Long Island guy?
Never taken the Long Island Railroad. I felt like some kind of reverse demented Rob Petrie, because he would take the train in from New Rochelle on the Dick Van Dyke show to do the Alan Brady show. And I was kind of like taking the train from Manhattan, from Penn Station out to Bethpage. You tend to think, or I've only thought of like doing a TV show as a thing you do somewhere in LA with LA things. And then suddenly you're driving out to Long Island. There's nobody does show business around here. And it's fantastic. I think all writers should be forced to live somewhere other than LA for some portion of their career. Maybe everybody in the show business should, like kind of a year abroad program, just to remind yourself that it isn't normal the way we do things.
Has it informed how you approach the show?
Yeah, you start thinking, there's nobody else here. So you start thinking, when you want to show a Christmas tree lot, you build one outside your soundstage because it's snowy and the trees are bare. And like you do all sorts of stuff. It just feels different. It felt different and fantastic until the second snowstorm. Then it felt different and like, get me out of here. But that's normal. I mean, I grew up back east, so I'm used to it.
Yes, you're doing it wrong. You're in Long Island in the dead winter. It's not
yeah,
meant to
exactly
do that
right,
Rob.
Exactly right.
Rob Long, host of KCRW's Martini Shot and executive producer, showrunner of Kevin Can Wait on CBS. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks this week to WUGA in Athens, Georgia, which is where I am this week in the final rounds of judging the Peabody Awards. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.